KALW.
So these are young people who were in the foster care system, products of that system, and they often lack mentors, role models, and other people who have experience and life skills.
Emeryville is building an affordable housing project for two specific underserved social groups.
And the social science shows that when you co-locate those cohorts of people, you get really amazing outcomes.
We hear about the plans to house senior citizens and foster youth. Then a Bay Area photographer recounts his experience covering the George Floyd protests in Minneapolis.
There's a lot of uncertainty and sometimes fear when somebody sticks a camera in your face.
And San Francisco author Ingrid Rojas Contreras reads from her latest book. That's coming up. I'm Hannah Baba, and this is Cross Currents. The Bay Area continues to have some of the highest real estate and rental prices in the nation. And that means affordable housing is in short supply and great demand. Most cities in the Bay Area are seeing the construction of mostly market-rate housing. But in Emeryville, the city's government is building housing that'll be affordable for two specific marginalized social groups, senior citizens and foster youth. KALW's Sunni Khalid recently spoke with Emeryville Mayor John Bodders about the project.
The project on San Pablo Street, it is described as the state's first intergenerational residential housing unit. What does that mean? And we're talking about people who have aged out of the foster care program, and we're talking about seniors.
Yes, the 4300 San Pablo intergenerational housing is a housing model that has been done elsewhere in the world. Also here in the United States, there are several really good examples of intergenerational projects, and they rely on good health information about social outcomes related to co-locating the housing of seniors who are of lower income or fixed income means, who are usually alone and want to live independently still. They don't want to be in assisted living, nursing care, but they would benefit from social stimulation, not being kind of off in a single family home setting, but being in an environment where there are other people for them to socialize with has massive health benefits for them cognitively and personally. They are a really good match, actually, from a social space with transition-aged youth. So you'll sometimes see the abbreviation TAY, that's transition-aged youth. Those are youth who are aging out of homeless or foster care services. So these are young people, typically between the ages of 18 and 25, who have no permanent or fixed adult figure in their life often. And so these are young people who were in the foster care system, products of that system, and they often lack mentors, role models, and other people who have experience and life skills that can really enrich their transition into adulthood. And the social science shows that when you co-locate those cohorts of people, you get really amazing outcomes. So that intergenerational transfer of knowledge, older people teaching younger people how to open a bank account, how to save money, sharing life experiences with them that help people make choice, young people make choices for themselves. Young people being able to show an older person how to use technology to contact a grandchild that lives across the country, perhaps, do other things that help them live independently and stay in their community independent. Those types of social bonds and that type of health outcome is really positive and something that's very consistent with Emeryville's values. And so this project that's at 4300 San Pablo will have about 20% of the units will be for youth and 80% for seniors. Emeryville was the sponsor in 2021 of a bill, Senate Bill 591, which was carried by Senator Becker. Prior to that bill being passed, it was not legal in California, even though federally it was allowed. It was not legal in California for low-income housing tax credits that were being used for any type of senior unit could not have any other type of housing in the building. So seniors were essentially getting affordable housing, but it was completely isolated and only dedicated for seniors. And there were some good reasons why people originally put that law into place, was to protect funding for seniors. But we were able to go in and amend that law in a way that did not harm funding for seniors, but said, listen, there are these really good societal benefits for putting and co-locating young people who need mentorship and affordable housing in the same space and having programming in the building through through providers that the nonprofit developer will partner with to bring those two groups together. So that's what we're going to do with that project. We do hope to be the first state-funded intergenerational housing project to have it in Emeryville.
What is it about Emeryville? It's very small, very compact. Some people may not even know it's a city, but there is a character and it's very close knit. What is it about your community that lends itself toward pursuing these kinds of options? I mean, you could make far more money and bring in much richer residents. What is it about Emeryville that makes it unique in this respect?
Emeryville is an amazing town. I since moving to the Bay Area over a decade ago, I have not lived in any other community in the Bay Area other than Emeryville, and I don't foresee that I would ever live in another community in the Bay Area outside of Emeryville. It is a really unique community. You're right. A lot of people don't even know it's a city. People think it's a neighborhood of Oakland. People say, oh, that's where the Pixar or the IKEA are. That's what they know about us. But it really does have, there's 13,000 residents there. They're hardworking people. We are a diverse community. And there's a lot of support for affordable housing, for ensuring that our community remains diverse and accessible. The city historically was a place for low-income creative class, so artists. Back when those who are from the Bay Area will remember when it was nothing more than industrial buildings and factories and mud flats. And the people who first inhabited Emeryville when it kind of the industrial core rotted out, so to speak, were artists. And I think that kind of avant-garde and creative class approach to the last 30 to 40 years in Emeryville has really given it the character it has as a city that is willing to try things, is willing to be inclusive. I think that's the word I would use to describe our community most, is that it is a very inclusive community. And there's been support for, time and again, voters have supported the recommendations our council has made for these types of projects.
What kind of feedback are you getting from your constituents?
So, I mean, I get emails from residents who say, I've put my name on a list for a senior housing project. When will that one on San Pablo come available? I would really love to stay here. My rent keeps going up. Can we build it faster? I mean, people want it. And, we've had neighborhood meetings with folks when we've brought other housing projects online in the past where people have questions or they want to know, like, what will the impact be? But in the end, we just have a very transparent and open conversation with our community about what our vision is for that. And we've not really ever had the type of opposition you see in some other communities in the Bay Area where people feel really defensive about new people coming or an apartment building being three stories tall. I mean, some of the things that I see in other communities, just seem totally bizarre to me because those things don't happen in our city.
Is this a one-off, or do you think Emeryville will be able to do more kinds of housing like this in the future?
I would love to do more. We have other opportunities in the city. There are three sites on Christie Avenue where it's an open call for proposals right now as to what to build. We've made it clear we want to build as much affordable housing, as many as 300 to 350 units on those sites. There are a couple other properties in the city that will be future housing opportunities where the property is the only reason they're not under development already in some way is because there were environmental remediations required, which we're finishing work on those things. So there are future opportunities out there. We really hope that the project at 4300 San Pablo is an exemplary one and one that inspires other cities to follow our lead and create spaces like this for important members of our community. So I would love to see a second project or a third project here in our city at some point.
That was Emeryville Mayor John Botters speaking with KALW's Sunni Khalid. Thank you. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. Richmond photographer Corey Suzuki was a college student living in the Minneapolis area when protests erupted over the police killing of George Floyd. Corey grabbed his camera and captured history. He jumped over fences and took photos even as rubber bullets hit him. Because of his work, UC Berkeley's Journalism School awarded him a fellowship this year, and we're also proud to say that Corey is an alum of KALW's summer training program. KALW's Janae Darden spoke with Corey about his passion for photojournalism.
Okay, so you're from Richmond. Shout out to Richmond. I have a lot of family in Richmond. Is that where you started getting into photography when you were in Richmond growing up?
Yeah, I mean, I think it really started with my sister, to be honest. She was the one who was always trying new things when we were little. She's 2 years younger than I am, but she was the one who started photography with like this, I don't know, it was kind of like a junky old hand-me-down from my uncle, but she would like drag me out into the city, into the hills to try and practice. And so it was through her that I started getting interested and started kind of learning how to take pictures too. And so that was, yeah, that was really the beginning.
I know I read that you were inspired by the late photographer Gordon Parks. What was it about his work that you loved and that also inspired you when it comes to your own photography?
I think the thing that I was so struck by and that continues to, I think, be a huge inspiration is just the way that in telling all of these different stories, the huge range of stories that he told, really the focus on small moments, on kind of like the moments that aren't like the big moments that we think about when we think about photojournalism, that aren't the the captures of action or of things happening or of events unfolding, but sort of like just the really small and intimate moments of somebody sweeping dust off the floor or looking out the window smoking. Just that kind of the quietness of those moments and how much they come up in his work to show someone is not a slice of something, just like one piece of who they are, but to sort of like show in a full extent who they are by capturing like all of the different things that happen in someone's day. I feel like it's just really inspiring.
So did you cover the Black Lives Matter protest over the murder of George Floyd?
I did. I think there were three other students. It was me and three other students who were part of our student newspaper and who were still there in the Twin Cities when George Floyd was murdered.
How did you focus when it's like all, I mean, it's rubber bullets flying, it's people chanting, it's people running, it's police, it's helicopters, it's, you know, people getting hurt, people helping people. And how do you, when you're taking those photos, how do you focus? How are you able to like get that shot?
In a lot of cases, I think this is like part of how I think about photography generally. But situations like a protest, especially, I think we really are like taking pictures. I think there's a big like there are a lot of photographers who make distinctions between the idea of making a picture versus the idea of taking a picture, and I think a lot of photographers think about making like to think about it as making more, because that kind of brings into focus sort of the agency of the photographer and like how a photograph isn't just a capture of any kind of impartial reality. Like the photographer, what the photographer sees, the biases the photographer brings to the photo, the thought process, it's all just like it's very every image is very controlled. But I still do think that like the idea of taking is also important to think about, because I think, yeah, just in a lot of cases we are taking people's images. And so I think the reason or the thing that I learned from a lot of these photographers and you know, community members who I talked to about this too, there's a lot of uncertainty and sometimes fear when somebody sticks a camera in your face or is just photographing. And so I think putting that time into talking to people, not even necessarily for like a long time, but just to kind of explain what you're doing, get to know a little about them, share a little bit about yourself, to bridge that gap before you take something from them, I think.
Because of your coverage, you recently won Berkeley's 2022 Dorothea Lange Fellowship Grant for a photo documentary project. And I understand you're going to be doing a project related to Japanese Americans in World War II.
Yeah, that's the plan. It's a project that is largely inspired by my grandma's story. And it's about a group of Japanese Americans, a large group of Japanese Americans who didn't spend the war in sort of the way that I think many Americans are taught about what happened to Japanese Americans mm-hmm. during the war, and that the federal government rounded them up and put them in incarceration camps. But there was actually a large group of people who spent the war across the ocean in Japan, stranded there after travel between the U.S. and Japan was cut off.
Was your grandmother, because you're photographing your grandmother for this, was she stranded in Japan and wanted to come back home?
She was, yeah. She was one of the people who, she was born in San Francisco in 1932. Then she and her parents at a certain point went back to Japan to take care of her grandma, to take care of family. And then they were stranded in Japan during the war.
How long were they stranded, the entire war?
Yeah. And for, I think, a few years after, my grandma was able to come home pretty quickly after the war because she was able to get her citizenship back. But her parents didn't. Her parents were first generation immigrants. They didn't have citizenship.
Just from looking at your work and knowing the work that you've done, you're very interested, it seems like, in culture and social justice issues when it comes to storytelling. You were an intern with us at KLW Audio. And now you're a wonder with the camera. You're in graduate school at Cal studying journalism. What do you want to do?
I mean, I really just want to keep, not to get too mushy about KLW, but I do want to keep, I think, like carrying on what I learned with you and the team. And just, I guess what I mean is that in-depth and really thorough reporting and journalism and elevating stories, but also just like a focus on community and on what people need, what information is helpful for people, what information is practically useful, and then just like what's happening in an area on the local level. But I don't know what exactly that's going to look like. I just know that I want to be connected to a place. Like I had the privilege of being connected to the Twin Cities, and like I have and continue to have the privilege of being connected to the Bay, too.
That was photographer Corey Suzuki speaking with KELW's Janae Darden, and that interview was produced with help from Porfirio Rangel. You can see Corey's photos on his Instagram and website. We've got the links at KELW.org. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Next, we'll hear a reading about one woman's journey to reclaim her family's otherworldly legacy. It's another episode from KELW's literary podcast, New Arrivals.
This is New Arrivals, a pocket-sized book tour with Bay Area authors. I'm Lisa Morehouse. Ingrid Rojas Contreras lives in San Francisco. Her book, The Man Who Could Move Clouds, came out on July 12th, 2022.
It's about memory and amnesia and about my grandfather, who was a curandero, who people said could move clouds. I'm going to read to you the beginning pages. They say the accidents that left me with temporary amnesia is my inheritance. No house or piece of land or chest of letters, just a few weeks of oblivion. Mammy had temporary amnesia as well, except when she was 8 years old, I was 23. When she fell down an empty well, I crashed my bicycle into an opening car door. When she nearly bled to death in Ocaña, Colombia, in darkness, 30 feet below the earth, I got to my feet seemingly unharmed and wandered around Chicago on a sunny winter afternoon. When she didn't know who she was for 8 months, I couldn't remember who I was for 8 weeks. They say the amnesias were a door to gifts we were supposed to have, which Mami's father Nono neglected to pass.
That was Ingrid Rojas Contreras reading from The Man Who Could Move Clouds.
New Arrivals is produced by Lisa Morehouse, and you can hear more readings at klw.org. And here's some new music from a Bay Area artist. This is pianist John R. Burr, and he'll be playing in Oakland Sound Room this Friday. Today's Cross Currents team includes Hanisha Herjani, Raphael Cohen, James Rollins, Gabe Graben, Victor Tense, Shirin Adil, Shaya Levitt, Sunni Khalid, and Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet as interpreted by Daoud Anthony. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.